Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Rajiv, for the introduction, and thanks to the organizing committee and the program chair and the program committee for giving me the opportunity to talk here. So I'll be talking on logic in software, dynamical and biological systems. These are just for some reason this is so. I sort of chose a very broad title for the talk, and when I started preparing the slides, it got a really a long talk, but let's see how far I can get with it. So one thing to keep, the view I take of problems is usually there are three classes of problems that I like to see from a logical perspective. One are you're given some description, okay? Let's say E is the description of the problem you're interested in, and you what you typically want to do with a given description is you want to find some desired description E prime such that one of these three things can happen. Either you want equivalence preserving things in some logic. That is, you want to find E prime which is equivalent to E but has some nice properties. So this typically happens, for example, in linear equation solving or in solving nonlinear equations, as in Grubner basis, or in computer algebra, or in theorem proving, and so on. The second class of problems is when you want to check an implication. You start with E, and you want to check whether E implies E prime, or you want to find a E prime which is implied by E, but which has certain nice properties. And this is typically the verification problem. So you're given some E, you're given some E prime, and you want to check whether E implies E prime. And the third is the opposite, or the dual of it, which is synthesis or diagnosis. The nice thing about 2 and 3 is that you can do... sorry about that. Okay. So... the nice thing about 2 and 3 is that you can do, since you're not required to preserve equivalence, you can do lots of approximations, abstractions, and that's what this talk is all about. So my talk will focus on verification and synthesis, the things that are marked in red. Here's a brief motivation for doing analysis. So my talk title has three topics, right? So biological systems, which is a couple of models from systems biology on the right-hand side. Programs, which is a small flowchart in the middle, and on the left-hand side are models of or dynamical systems, basically. And what you want to do with them is basically formal methods, which is I want to model and analyze these systems. So there are two aspects. One is you want to model the systems formally, and the second is you want to write properties of the systems in some specification language. Okay. So what are formal models of dynamical systems? So there are two aspects to it. You want to define what time axis is and what is the state space of your system. Again, there are three choices in time. You can have discrete time, the set of natural numbers, continuous time, which is the set of real numbers, or hybrid time, which is n cross r, okay? And similarly, the state space can again be either purely discrete. In the first case, you have n Boolean variables and let's say m variables that take values over the naturals. So we have a discrete state space, which is 2 to the n cross the naturals to the m. Or you can have a continuous state space in which you have n real valued variables, or you have a hybrid state space, which is you have some continuous real value variables, m real valued variables, and n Boolean variables. Okay? And then the semantics of these dynamical systems would then just be mappings from whatever time axis you chose to whatever state space you picked. Okay? So I'll give you examples of these three different kinds of systems. The first one, so this is the outline of my talk. I'll start with continuous dynamical systems because you're very familiar with state transition systems and the verification problems there and the approaches there. So I'll start with continuous dynamical systems, and I'll show that the verification problem in continuous dynamical systems, a nice way of verifying continuous dynamical systems is by reducing it to an exist for all solving problem. In the second part of the talk, I'll extend that to hybrid system verification, and I'll show that hybrid system verification Again, a nice approach for verifying hybrid systems is by reducing it to an exist for all solving plus some discrete system verification. Synthesis, in turn, it turns out, also reduces to exist for all solving, and you can do lots of very neat synthesis for particular application domains by solving exist for all formulas. So since the first three parts basically map very interesting problems to exist for all solving, I have a small section, part four, on solvers for exist for all formulas. In part five, I have a few slides on systems biology, and on part six, I have one of my favorite topics, which is program verification, in which you don't solve exist for all formulas, but you approximate logical operators. Okay. So what are continuous dynamical systems? Continuous dynamical systems are just basically systems that are described by differential equations. So it's a tuple. You have, let's say, n real valued variables x. You have a vector field, which is a mapping from Rn to Rn, and an invariant region, which is a subset of Rn, a subset of your state space. An example is on the right-hand side. You have two variables, let's say x1, x2. You have a vector field, f x1, x2, given by this pair. And you have an invariant region, which is the whole of the R2 plane. And that what it means is basically it's a dynamical system with these differential equations. Dx1 by dt is minus x1 minus x2, and dx2 by dt is x1 minus x2. Okay. The semantics is just the solutions of these differential equations. But you can also give a semantics to a dynamical system as a state transition system. Okay. The state transition is, so the semantics is a structure in which the state space, the universe, is R to the n, which is the state space of the system. And you have a binary relation on Rn, which is basically all pairs of points in the state space, such that there is some solution to the differential equation that takes you from here to here. Okay, so what it means is that each state has an uncountably infinitely many successors, depending on what time step you choose. Okay, that's what is written in the bottom of the slide. So once I give a semantics of a continuous dynamical system as a state transition system, I can ask all kinds of model checking. I have semantics for, I can get temporal logics, and I have semantics, well-defined semantics of temporal logics, the model checking problem. So that's the reason for giving a state transition system semantics for a continuous dynamical system. And it also helps when we define the semantics of hybrid systems later on. Okay. So once we have these continuous dynamical systems and we have defined the semantics, so we know the problem of, for example, safety verification is well defined now. So what do we know in terms of what are the results that are already there? So the best result that I know for continuous dynamical systems is that you can compute exact reachable sets for a restricted class of linear systems. And this restricted class is basically linear systems of the form dx by dt equals ax plus b, where a satisfies certain certain properties. For example, a is diagonalizable with all rational eigenvalues, or a is diagonalizable with purely imaginary rational eigenvalues, or a is important, and so on. In all cases, the essential idea of computing reach sets is very simple. You basically do a change of variables and show that after a change of variables, the reachable set is a semi-algebraic set, which can be obtained using quantified elimination techniques. Okay. So, okay, I'll not be giving too many technical details in the talk. My purpose is just to give you a feeling for the various results out there and what is known and what is the state of the art, so to say. So one technique that is being used not just by computer scientists but also by control engineers in verifying continuous dynamical systems is what I'll call certificate-based verification. The idea is very simple. Again, remember the verification is a problem of class 2, which is the implication problem. An implication problem means that you can do abstractions. You can apply the cut rule and do nice things. So a certificate, for example, for you want to prove M is a model of your system, phi is your some property in some temporal logic. You want to prove M models phi. So what one way of proving it is you find another capital phi, such that phi is stronger than your phi, the first point, and the second point, which is that checking this capital phi is somehow easier, okay? So it's locally checkable, which Examples are usually handy over here. So for example, if you're verifying a safety property, this capital C, a certificate for a safety property, is an inductive invariant. Inductive invariants are locally checkable. That's the nice thing about inductiveness of inductive invariants. Similarly, for stability, if you want to prove a continuous dynamical system or any dynamical system is stable, you typically try to find a Lyapunov function. And again, a Lyapunov function is a certificate for stability verification. Okay, and the reason it's a certificate is that it's locally checkable. You can check it very easily, just like an inductive invariant is locally checkable, and so on and so forth. So how do you apply this idea of certificate-based verification? Is you want to prove M models phi. So of course, by certificate-based verification, what I'll do is I'll try to find a certificate, capital phi, for this small phi. Now, by the definition of certificate, I know that both these checks, this check in particular is a local check, so I can sort of write some formula and some logic which will capture this check. But still, remember that this quantification is over the certificate, which is either a inductive, is a set, or a Lyapunov function, or a function, which is, so it's not a first order quantifier. But what you can do is you can fix the form of the inductive invariant that you're interested in, or the set you're interested in, or the function you're interested in, and then replace the higher order quantifier by just a first order quantifier by picking a template for this C. So an example, example comes next, I think, after a while. So, okay, the example will be up in just in a couple of slides. Before an example, of course, what is, so what's a certificate, for example, for safety verification of a continuous dynamical system? So of course, the question is, what is an inductive invariant for a dynamical system, for a continuous dynamical system? For discrete state transition systems, we know that the definition of inductiveness is over here. It is that it's preserved. A set is inductive if every transition preserves it. So if you're in the set and you make a transition, a single step transition, you are still in the set. Okay, that's how we prove, that's the definition of inductiveness. Now we can take the semantics of a continuous dynamical system as a state transition system and apply this definition. So we have a definition of inductive sets for continuous dynamical systems. So that's not a problem. But that is not very useful because, as I said, the semantics was defined in terms of solutions of differential equations and it had uncountably many successors. So here's a problem. A simple instance of the problem. I give you a continuous dynamical system like the one I had before, and I ask, is this set inductive? A set x1 squared plus x2 squared less than or equal to 0.5, which is basically a circle in 2D space. So the intuition for checking inductiveness of a set like this is basically saying that the vector field on the boundary of the set, because things are continuous, actually continuous dynamical systems are nice because things are continuous and smooth, so at the boundary of this set, you want the vector fields to point inwards, okay? Which sort of boils down to this check. That is, suppose you want to check that p less than or equal to 0 is inductive, where p is this x1 squared plus x2 squared minus 0.5. To prove that p is inductive, what I need to check is when p becomes 0, that is, when you hit the boundary of this set p less than or equal to 0, which is p equal to 0, then the rate of change of p is negative, which means that it will immediately come back a negative value, or its first derivative is 0, but the second derivative pushes it in, or the first two derivatives are 0, and the third derivative pushes it in, and so on and so forth. Or the fifth derivative, or the first n derivatives are 0, and the n plus 1 derivative pushes you in. Or all the derivatives are identically 0. Okay? So that's your check for inductiveness. Now, of course, it's not a finite check. Now, again, I'll not go into details over here, but You can get several sound checks, as you can imagine, by dropping these disjuncts. I'll just check the first derivative or the first two derivatives. But you can also get complete checks for special cases. Okay. So let me apply this this certificate-based verification and the definition of inductiveness to this problem that we had. So you have this dynamical system from before, And the problem is some safety verification problem. In this case, now I say if you start with x1 less than equal to 5 and x2 less than equal to, x1 less than equal to 0.5 and x2 less than equal to 0.5, prove that it's always the case that x2 is bounded by 1. Okay? It's a safety verification problem. And the idea of how do I prove this? I'll say I'll find a certificate, an inductive invariant of the form p less than equal to 0, where p is of the form ax1 squared plus bx2 squared plus c, where I don't know what a, b, and c are. So here's where I'm converting this second order quantifier into a first order quantifier. Instead of saying find some set p less than equal to 0, I'll say find a set of the form ax1 squared plus bx2 squared plus c less than equal to 0. Okay? I'm just choosing a template for p, which means that now I have to find values a, b, and c, so that for all x, y, it's inductive. P less than equal to 0 is inductive, which means that if whenever you hit the boundary of the set, the first derivative is negative. This is a strong condition, of course, but this is sufficient, not necessary maybe. The inductive invariant P less than 0 is stronger than what you want to prove. This is the property you want to prove. And the initial states are contained in P less than equal to 0. Okay? Now, if you solve this exist for all formula, using some tool, and we'll come back and say this is in fact a true formula in the theory of reals. It's in fact a decidable theory, the first order theory of reals, and that will show you that this in fact is a you will complete the verification. So you would have proved that that g of x2 less than equal to 1. It's always the case that x2 is less than equal to 1. Okay. Now, certificate-based verification, I did it for inductive invariants. As I said, people have been doing this for stability for a long time. How have we been proving stability of dynamical systems? We have been proving it by showing that we can construct Lyapunov functions, again, by solving exist-for-all formulas. I say, find me a quadratic Lyapunov function, and again, you write a big exist-for-all formula, and you say, well, the solution to this exist-for-all formula gives you a Lyapunov function and proves stability. But of course, in control theory, one of the first basic results when we take the first course in control is basically we say that we don't need to solve exist for all formulas. We say that for linear systems, we can decide stability just by analyzing the matrix A, whether all its eigenvalues are of a certain form. So the same question, for certain classes of dynamical systems, can I find good inductive invariants without solving exist for all formulas? So it turns out, there's very nice relationship in the sense that if you take the left eigenvectors of this, again, consider this linear system dx by dt equals ax, then any left eigenvector of A corresponding to some real eigenvalue lambda will give you a nice inductive invariant. Okay. So P over here is just, if C is your left eigenvector, then C times X, so C1 X1 plus C2 X2, less than equal to 0 or greater than 0 are both inductive sets. And these have been called, so these inductive sets of this form were discovered, or these definition of inductive sets for continuous dynamical systems and the use for proving safety of dynamical systems was kind of discovered almost in some sense, independently by computer scientists, and we call it inductive invariance, and by control theorists, they call it barrier certificates. So both terms are used. Barrier certificates is more popular in the control community. And you can use this to prove, for example, say, collision avoidance of cruise controllers in cars. So I'll not go into that. So that was the first part. Moving on to the second part, so I was just talking about continuous dynamical systems, now we can talk about hybrid systems. Hybrid systems is basically a finite collection of continuous dynamical systems with switchings, okay? So imagine a finite state machine, a finite state automata, and inside each state of the automata is sitting, you have a continuous dynamical system sitting inside. So you have a finite set of states Q, inside each state Q, you have a continuous dynamical system, CDS, Q, and then you have some discrete jumps. Okay? So again, the semantics is very simple. Now the state space is Q times Rn, and your transition relation is basically a union of your discrete transitions, with the semantics of the dynamic assistance in each mode, just like before we, just like what we had before for the semantics of continuous dynamic assistance. So now an example of hybrid automata is a simple bouncing ball. Imagine a ball that's falling freely and it bounces off the ground. When it bounces off the ground, it loses 10% of its velocity, okay? So you have just one mode because the ball falls freely all the time. And there are two variables. Y is the position, is the vertical position of the ball from the ground, and V is the velocity of the ball in the Y direction. So of course the dynamics are dy by dt is V and dv by dt is minus 9.8, which is it's falling under gravity, freely under gravity. So this is your vector field. And the discrete transition is given by, there's only one mode. So when you're in mode one, in mode Q, and your position is zero, that is you're hitting the ground, and your velocity is V, then you stay in the same mode. Your position is still zero, you're still on the ground, but your velocity is now, you're pointing upwards with a negative sign, okay, and you've lost 10% of your velocity. So this is like a discrete transition. So a bouncing ball is an example of a hybrid automata. So as I said, you can again give semantics of, I gave you semantics of hybrid automata as discrete state transition systems, and again you can ask what's the complexity of the model checking problem and so on. Now there are restricted classes, so what is known about model checking a hybrid system? So what is known is that there are simple kinds of hybrid, special classes of hybrid systems. Timed automata, for example, are hybrid systems in which there are only clocks, so all continuous variables have derivative one. And guards have a specific form and so on. And there is another class of, a more general class called linear hybrid automata, which again have sort of linear dynamics, but the dynamics are constrained by the there's a technical definition for linear hybrid automata. The dx by dt, there's a linear relationship on the linear constraints on the dx by dt variables, on the derivatives. Now, model checking problems are decidable for timed automata, but undecidable for linear hybrid automata, and the boundary is well studied. There's automata in between for which people have studied the reachability problem and so on. So of course, so there's a big gap, right, in the sense that the kinds of systems you want to model are sometimes more than just timed automata. Timed automata are tremendously useful for modeling lots of things, but when we want to model control systems, they may be too restrictive. So clearly there are, but again, remember that we are interested in the verification problem, which is M models free. Again, I'll do all these approximation tricks, which is I can use abstraction. So I already showed you one way, which is a certificate-based verification, which is an incomplete method. Remember that you're applying a cut rule in some sense. You say you're finding a stronger capital C. This was a certificate-based verification thing that I just described, but you can also do another trick, which is you find a weaker M prime, so that M implies M prime is some weaker, is an abstraction, and then M prime models phi is somehow easier to decide than M models phi, okay? And that's what abstraction is, okay? So one abstraction that we have found lately, this is a very recent work, is what we call relational abstractions of hybrid systems. And relational abstractions are basically an example, I think is better. So a relational abstraction is a abstraction of a differential of a continuous dynamical system. So suppose you consider the simple example, dx by dt equals minus x. So it's an exponential thing, so just one variable x. If you start with some positive value of x, you are exponentially decreasing and approaching zero. If you start with a negative value of x, you are increasing and approaching zero from the other direction. So that's the dynamics. A relational abstraction of this would be would be a relationship between the initial value of x and some final value of x prime. So I'll replace this differential equation by a discrete transition from x to x prime, and I'll say that this discrete transition is possible whenever either x is positive and x prime is less than x, is between 0 and x, or x is negative and x prime is between x and 0, or both are 0. Okay. So this is over approximation of the discrete semantics of this differential equation. Okay. In this particular case, in this particular example, it's actually a complete description. There's no loss of information. It's not really an over approximation. It's exact in this particular example. But in many other examples, when the dynamics are more complicated than just this, you can get approximations. Okay. You can find good linear relations between x and x prime variables which hold for whenever the concrete system can make a transition from x to x prime. So the neat thing about relational abstractions is that uniformly handles a large class of hybrid systems. For timed automata, the relational abstraction, in fact, again, it's complete. There's no loss of information. It's simply suppose you have a time system with two clocks, x dot equals 1, y dot equals 1, then this is your relational abstraction. It says the change in the value of x is equal to the change in the value of y, and x prime should be greater than or equal to x. For if you have clocks with different rates, again, you can get a relational abstraction. Again, there's no loss. But of course, when you go more general, there's a loss. But the neat thing about this loss is that this, as long as A has this nice eigenstructure, it has all rational eigenvalues, or the more rational eigenvalues it has, the better quality relational abstractions you have. Okay? And you can compute relational abstractions for linear dynamics, so x dot equals ax, and for all these other, x dot equals ax plus b, without solving any exist for all formulas. But of course, in the more general case, when the dynamics are not linear, you can again get relational abstractions by using the same approach that we used, the certificate-based approach. You can find relational abstractions that are linear by solving exist for all formulas in the general case when the dynamics are not linear. As I said, these are complete for several classes of systems. In fact, they are complete for even linear hybrid automata. But what they give you is, now you started with a hybrid system, what they give you is an infinite state, discrete state transition system, so you can then use your favorite tools to verify that, like a bounded model checker, a K-induction prover, or just abstract interpretation, or whatever you may choose to have. Okay, so that was the second part of the talk. So, yes? On T. That's right. And it's a over approximation of the quantified elimination of T. Some over approximation may not be exact quantified elimination of T, right? And you can add more.
Okay, so you find a relation abstraction
in over approximation, but it's a quantified formula that can be found. Yeah, without T, yes. Now you can study timed relational abstractions in which you say what is the relationship between your first value and your final value? What could possibly happen in five time steps? Now, the time relational abstraction may be useful when you're analyzing time-triggered systems and so on, but that's not the point here. That's right. So there was another thing that came to my mind when we were asking this question, but I seem to have forgotten what it was. Okay. So this are the first two parts. In both the parts, what I showed is you have to solve. One of the important things to do is solving exist for all formulas. Okay. Now in synthesis, how does exist for all come about in synthesis? Synthesis, as remember, is the dual of verification. So in verification, you're given a system, you want to check an implication, so you can do abstractions on all these tricks. But in synthesis, you're given some specification and you want to synthesize a system. So you want to synthesize E prime, which will imply E. So it's just the opposite. So it's not a good, not the same as before. There are lots of examples of synthesis. So the particular instance of synthesis I'm interested in is this component-based synthesis. So I give you some base components, and I give you some set of composition operators, and I ask you, can you compose these components in some way so as to get a desired system? Okay. So for example, I can ask you, give me an algorithm to sort an array, and the components that I give you are comparators. Or compute the average, and I give you just modular arithmetic operators. Or if I give you a bit vector, I give you bitwise operators, arithmetic operators, and I give you a bit vector, and your task is to find the position of the rightmost one in that bit vector. Or I give you some bookie automata, and I give you some Omega regular language, and I ask you to compose, and I give you some notions of composition, and I ask you to compose these bookie automata so that you accept a given Omega regular language. I give you multiple dynamical systems, continuous dynamical systems, and I ask you to synthesize a safe hybrid system which has some safety property by switching at the right times between these dynamical systems. So synthesize the switching logic. I say that all you are allowed to do is ruler and compass steps, and then I ask you construct a triangle, an equilateral triangle, for example, just using ruler and compass. I give you an obfuscated code or parts of an obfuscated code, and I ask you construct an equivalent code which has the same behavior but uses only these parts of this code so that it removes some obfuscated part and in the end gives you a simpler program. Or, I mean, more generally, I can just say, I give you these inference rules and give me a proof. So these are basically questions of synthesis. Does there exist a composition using components F1, F2, some set of base library components, some class of composition operators such that you meet some given specification? So it's a very general class. And of course, you can concretize the synthesis problem by fixing the class of operators you're interested in, the class of specification, the class of component specifications, and so on. Now, the reason it's an inverse is an abduction problem, because you're given this and you want to find this, and then this is not in some sense well defined, because this is you want to find something. I mean, a false over here would satisfy this, an implication of this one. So what you typically do in bounded synthesis is that you start making this problem more concrete, and you concretize it in two ways. You say, I'm not interested in some unbounded number of components, some bounded number of components, let's say just three components. And then again, not just arbitrary set of compositions, but some composition from a finite set of compositions. Okay? Now this problem becomes well defined. It just becomes, exactly over what's written over here. So now you can then solve the synthesis problem by deciding this exists for all formula. The existential variable is over the is sort of doing a search on the possible programs. Suppose you're doing program synthesis, and the for all variables are basically all your program the program variables for which you're given. For which a specification has been provided. So some examples, you can synthesize straight line programs this way, you can find loop free program synthesis, you can synthesize geometry constructions. And in all cases, what you're doing is you're boiling down the synthesis problem into a exist for all formula. So what we have been able to do are basically apply this idea of bounded synthesis, somehow make synthesis bounded, and then solve exist for all formulas. And we have applied it to very different domains. Synthesis in general is very difficult, but you can apply it to very specific domains and get very neat results. One of the domains we applied it to is bit vector operators, which is the third line in an example of bit vector tricks. So suppose I give you a bit vector and find the position of the rightmost one. It's a tricky thing to come up with, right? But there's a two or three line program that does that. So you can give it to a synthesizer, and our synthesizer will construct the program. We have also done the same thing for geometry constructions, a little bit, some examples for deobfuscation and so on. And here's for example a program that we can synthesize. So for example, I give you a bit vector x, and I ask you to round it up to the next highest power of 2. Okay, we can synthesize this, or we can synthesize, compute the higher order half of x times y, where x and y are given inputs. You can do lots of other interesting things, like for specific domains, one of my collaborators on the synthesis work, Sumit, has developed on Excel spreadsheet, you can show examples of what you want to do, some transformations, and beneath the front end, you basically solve an exist for all formula and synthesize a small program that actually does those transformations from examples. It's a very nice demo that maybe you'll get some some point you get a chance to see. So, okay, so the first three parts, that's the end of the first half of the talk. In all these three cases, I boiled down, I showed that you can solve lots of interesting problems by solving exist for all formulas. So you need exist for all solvers for different theories. Now, I didn't tell you which theory that I'm talking about, because partly the theory comes from which application. Are you synthesizing bit vector programs? Are you verifying dynamical systems? If you're verifying dynamical systems, then your theory is the theory of reals. If you're synthesizing bit vector programs, then your theory is the theory of bit vectors. So there are some standard approaches for solving exist for all problems. You can do quantified elimination. There are tools like QEPCAD and Redlock that will solve exist for all formulas in the theory of reals. Or you can just use some duality theorems like Farquharson-Lehmann and positive Stellan files from real algebraic geometry to replace one quantifier by another quantifier, and then you'll just have to solve a single quantifier formula. Or in some particular domains, you can do a SIGAR loop. SIGAR is this counterexample guided approach for exist for all solving. And then there are these other. So the first question to ask is, what have other people been doing? So I said that people have been finding Lyapunov functions by solving exist for all formulas. So what have they been using? So what they have been using is this thing called semi-definite programming or convex optimization. And beneath all the a semi-definite program is basically the feasibility instance of a semi-definite program that's written over there is basically an exist for all formula. A semi-definite program is basically minimize some linear function. So you want to find x's such that some c1 x1 plus c2 x2, you want to minimize that function subject to a constraint which says that this matrix is positive definite or semi-positive definite. Okay, so F0 and F1 and F2 and Fm are given matrices. They're n by n matrices, symmetric matrices. These are given to you as input. What you want to find are these xi's, such that once you sum these matrices, some linear combination of these matrices becomes positive definite. And positive definite simply means that y transpose times the matrix times y is greater than or equal to 0 for all y. So it's really an exist for all formula. So certain exist for all formulas are nicely, efficiently solvable. So that's the message to take home. And semi-definite programming is basically just a generalization of linear programming. A linear program can be written as a semi-definite program. And you can use interior point methods that you use for linear programs to solve semi-definite programs. And the trick you play is you basically, whenever you want to solve an exist for all formula, you try to abstract it or approximate it so that you can write it as a semi-definite program. So in this semi-definite program, you'll notice that the existential variables are all linear. So this term is linear in the existential variables, and it's quadratic in the for all variables. The first restriction is important, but the second is not so important, and that's what you get when you do sums of squares programming. Is another technique that people use for finding Lyapunov functions, and sums of SOS programming basically takes an SOS program and reduces it to SDP, a semi-definite program. So that's how it's working. But y can be non-linear over here. So sum of squares program basically solving constraints like this: you are given some polynomials p0, p1, p2, pm. These are fixed polynomials. And you're interested in finding xi. You have fixed polynomials over y, and you're interested in finding x, such that some linear combination of these polynomials becomes equal to a sum of squares. So this is not exactly being a sum of squares is not equivalent to saying that this is positive for all y, but it's a approximation, right? Sums of squares is sufficient to say that this will be positive for all y, but not the other way around. But anyway, the point is that there are some numerical tools that are available, efficient numerical tools that can solve very specific or very special classes of exist for all problems. But you might remember that the kinds of exist for all problems we were getting are of this form, right? Something, something and something implies something. And these classes don't directly solve these problems because they solve an atomic fact. Whereas this over here is a clause. You have Boolean variables. And this is very important because this contributes to the non-convexity, which means that you cannot use convex optimization, and all of these problems somehow rely on the fact that the solution spaces, at least for X, it's convex. But anyway, so that's the idea. The idea is that there are some tools that solve specific instances of exist for all problems. Some of the other tech tools that we have used are this counterexample guided exist for all solver, which is a generic approach for solving any exist for all. It doesn't work always, but it works for special theories. The idea is just is the same idea as counterexample guided abstraction refinement, which is if you want to solve this formula, you pick randomly some U naught, okay? Say you pick some, you guess some U naught, you verify, does that U naught work for all X? Now this is not an exist for all formula, it's just a for all formula. So a tool that can handle just one quantifier, like an SMT solver, can handle this. If it works, you're very lucky, you just guess the right solution in the first place and you return U naught. Of course, your guess is most likely going to be wrong, in which case you get a counterexample. You say, well, you pick the U naught, but it does not work for X naught. In that case, you just add X naught to your set X, and then you do finite synthesis. You synthesize a new U naught that works for all things that are in X. Again, this is a single quantifier. You can use a tool that handles a single quantifier, like an SMT solver, and then you repeat, okay? There are some other techniques, but I'll skip them. So that was just a flavor of some of the existing exist for all solvers that are there, some that we have developed that we have used to solve the synthesis problems or the verification problems that I mentioned in the first part of the talk. So my talk title had three things. It had dynamical systems, it had biology, and it had software systems. So I have a few slides on biology. Biology is a wide, systems biology is a wide area. There are lots of different things. So it's I'm going to concentrate on is one example, one particular example in which constraint solving plays a very important role. And it's a technique developed not by the computer scientists, but it's a technique that's developed by the biologists themselves. So let's see what it is. So these are some motivation slides for systems biology. I'll skip them. But the specific problem in which the biologists developed a constraint-solving technique for solving the problem is this nutrient set problem. So one of the things in a fact in biology is that there are lots of organisms for which we know the genome, but we can, and they grow in the wild, they grow in mud, and they grow out there, but we cannot grow them in the lab. Yeah, when we take them, we bring it to the lab, and we want to do some experiments, we cannot grow them because we don't know what food to give that will make it live, okay? What nutrients to provide. So the nutrient set problem is, I pick some arbitrary E. coli from the wild world. I can sequence the genome. There are good techniques to sequence the genome of this E. coli. From the genome, I can extract the genes. Again, there are standard tools that will do that. From the genes, there's a mapping of genes to proteins and enzymes and catalysts. So based on that, I can predict the metabolic network. I know which potential biochemical reactions are possible in the cell because it has a gene for producing those proteins. So I can predict the metabolic network. I get a huge metabolic network, but of course not all of it is active. And then from that metabolic network, my question is, will this particular organism grow on, if I give glucose and I give some kind of input material, using this metabolic network, can the organism synthesize some vital components that it needs for survival? And biologists have a good idea of what these vital components are, okay? So a metabolic network is just a set of, it's just a petri net, okay? So it has just rules of the form A plus B goes to C plus D, C plus A goes to E, but it's a petri net, but with each rule there is a real number, A1 and A2 in this case, which is somehow a numeric parameter that captures the relative affinity or preference or likelihood of that reaction over any other reaction, okay? So you can imagine that A, B, and C are molecules and they are just colliding randomly. But some reactions are more likely to happen. Some reactions are less likely to happen. So A1, A2 are basically reaction rates. You can model metabolic reaction networks using PetriNets. You can model cell signaling pathways using PetriNets. So what is the desired semantics of this PetriNet? The true to the biology or true to the physics semantics is that of a time stochastic PetriNet. Because as I said, these are molecules that are colliding, and so the chance of a reaction happening is really probabilistic. And the true semantics is given in terms of what is known as the chemical mastery equation, which is just is how you would give a semantics to a time stochastic PetriNet. Okay. The problem with analyzing things in this as a time stochastic PetriNet is that the, as you can imagine, the state space is large. It's in fact infinity, right? You have for each protein, you have a, I mean, these are proteins are, I mean, each protein is a variable, and the number of the value of this variable is over the natural. So it's an infinite state system, and then you have a probability distribution over this infinite set of states, and the probability distribution evolves. So there are lots of problems. Of course, it doesn't scale. There's a well-known stochastic simulation algorithm by Gillespie that does stochastic simulation of these chemical mastery equation or time stochastic PetriNets. But there's a problem of scalability, and the problem is there's another problem, which is you have to know what these A values are, these affinity values. So one solution to the scalability problem is to take this time stochastic PetriNet, do a huge approximation, and get a differential equation out of it. So there's a way to start with a time stochastic PetriNet and move to a differential equation. The idea is that you just collapse all the states. You just mix them up. So rather than keeping track that, well, the probability distribution is I have two A's and one B and zero CDEs and then one A with I have this with probability half, I have this state with probability half and this state with probability zero. Instead of keeping a probability distribution over the state space, what you say is I'll just take this probability distribution over all these different states, just collapse them and say, well, what's the probability that I will see a A? Okay, so you just keep the probability of seeing an A. Basically, you try to keep the marginals. You just say, what's the probability of seeing an A, what's the probability of seeing a B, what's the probability of seeing a C. It's a huge approximation, but this approximation is valid under very strong assumptions that the system is well mixed and so on, and you get what is known as the mass action semantics of these PetriNets. The third semantics is just a purely non-deterministic rewriting semantics. We say, well, all reactions can happen non-deterministically, in which case it's just a PetriNet. It's just a PetriNet reachability question. So reachability question or for PetriNet is hard, and in biology the models are large, so you don't want to do PetriNet reachability. What you want to do is approximation, and the approximation that you do is basically you do approximate reachability by just taking the PetriNet reachability problem and turning it into a constraints on the fluxes. Yeah. So you say, well, if suppose the initial state is 2a plus b and I want to reach d plus e, then all I need, if there is a path, and in this path I use r1 instances of the first rule and r2 instances of the second rule, then these r1 and r2 should satisfy these constraints. Okay? So this is balancing the number of a's produced and the a's consumed and b's produced and b's consumed by r1 firings of the first rule and R2 firings of the second rule, and this is called flux balance analysis. And this is a technique developed by the biologists. And so they have been using this for the last 10-15 years to build metabolic networks. So what we have done is just one slide. Is so what you want is reachability, which is the least fixed point. What flux balance analysis or this flux balance constraint gives you is the greatest fixed point. But you can do a lot of things in between, and we have a constraints that are stronger than the flux balance analysis constraints, still capture an over approximation of the least fixed point, which is reachability. So what our constraints capture is some fixed point in between the least and the largest. and using that constraint-based approach, we could get some interesting predictions, which were experimentally verified. So I'll not go into the biology or the details of the results, but you get the idea of the kinds of games you're playing over here. Okay, so the key thing in biology is to remember that we need techniques that scale. Okay, so we cannot use very extensive exist for all or very complicated solvers. We need simple linear programming or simple solvers that will just scale to large problems, and that's the trick that biologists have been playing over here. The last part of my talk, I have 10 minutes, is the one I find most interesting, which is logic in software verification. And over here, you'll see very interesting things come about. I'll do all this, the last part, as I've been doing in the previous ones, I'll do just through examples. So take an example of a simple program. You initialize x with 0, y 0, and z equals with n, and then you have a while loop. The star is a non-deterministic. I've abstracted away the conditional, so it's non-deterministic. I don't know when it'll terminate. Again, there's a if-then-else. Again, it's the condition has been abstracted away. So either you increment x and decrement z, or you increment y and decrement z. Okay. The task is to generate invariants of this program, because in the end you want to prove some assertions. Okay. So one way is the user gives you the user annotates the program with the loop invariants, in which case all you have to do is to verify these loop invariants. And the verification problem would then just be an implication. It will just be a for all problem. So just one quantifier, you just need to verify that for all x, y, z, x prime, y prime, z prime, this implication holds, okay? So you can just use an SMT solver if the SMT solver handles the theories that you have. But on the other hand, the technique that the preferred technique is not to assume that the user will annotate the program with loop invariants, but I will generate loop invariants myself. And how do I generate loop invariants? Is by doing abstract interpretation. Abstract interpretation is I'll just hold this in my hand. Abstract interpretation is you basically start with some initial state, in this case true, and then just propagate it through the program. Okay. So when you propagate it through some assignments, you need to do quantifier elimination. So for example, this state x equals 0, y equals 0, z equals n is obtained by doing a quantifier elimination on this formula on the right. And you propagate this state once again, you get, in the first step, you'll get x equals, you increment x, you decrement z, you get this value. Over here, you get this value. And so once the loop term, I mean, once the if then else merge, there's a join. So what the state over here is, either you take the if branch, in which case this is the state, or you take the else branch, in which case this is the state. So this is your state after one iteration. Okay, you're still doing abstract interpretation. You have to go through the loop, but currently this is your set of reachable states at this program point. But the key thing in abstract interpretation is that you want to forget things. Remember that, again, we are doing verification, which is analysis, so I want to abstract, I want to forget. So one of the things that you do in abstract interpretation is you say that I don't have disjunction. You just say that my logic is not rich enough to express disjunction. So all I can express is just, let's say, conjunctive facts. So now what you need is, I need over approximations of these logical operators. So look at this example over here. And so we had this state. This was the state that we were interested in, either x is 1, y is 0, or z equals n minus 1, or x was 0, y was 1, and z equals n minus 1. And we had or. We say that we don't have or in our language. I don't know what is or. I want to write this state without using an or, just as a conjunction of facts. So what is a conjunction of fact that is implied by this or? So, which is basically, I want a formula which is an over approximation of this set, and which is restricted to being in the conjunction of this theory, okay? So just conjunctions of atomic facts. So the fact you get is this fact, that x plus y equals 1 and z equals n minus 1. z equals n minus 1 is true on left hand side and true on the right hand side, so it's true here. And x equals 1, y equals 0, x equals 0, y equals 1. The only linear fact that you can get out of this disjunction is x plus y equals 1. It's true here, it's true here. Okay? So this is, so the idea of abstract interpretation is you over approximate the existential quantifier and the for all quantifier, and you over approximate it so that you the result is in some desired language. Over here, the desired language is a conjunction of atomic facts, linear equations. Okay? You do this a couple of times, and the interesting thing is after just one, after two iterations, you get the loop invariant completely automatically. So that's the idea of logical interpretation. You basically define a logical lattice, which is you restrict yourself in some way. You say, I'm only, in my elements of my lattice are just some subset of formulas in some theory. Okay? And your partial order is some subset of implication. Typically, if you can decide implication, then you just keep implication. You don't need a subset. But you can, if you want to. And then all these, the abstract interpretation operators are just boiled down to approximations of, over approximations of the logical AND or the logical OR and so on. Okay? So people have looked at these over approximation calculators, basically procedures that will calculate over approximation of an OR for different theories. Some of them are mentioned here. I'll skip the part on combining logical interpreters because there's not much, it's a little technical. But I'll briefly mention, because very cool, interesting things come up when you but very natural things from a logical point of view come up when you extend a abstract interpreter domain to a quantified abstract interpreter. In a quantified abstract interpreter, you want in a quantified abstract domain, you want to say facts which are quantified. Like say for all k between 0 and n, the array A at position k has value 0. So this is a quantified fact, a universal quantified fact. Now of course, when you propagate these universal facts, you can very well imagine what will happen. Since you want to keep over approximations, on the right hand side you typically have to do the same things that you had to do before as an over approximation, but since this part is on the left hand side of an implication, you have to start doing under approximations here. Okay. So let me just give you an example. So for example, let's look at the blue part. Which is a fact you will get after a couple of iterations of this loop. You get for all k, if k is 0, then ak is 0. And you get for all k, if k is 1, then ak is equal to 0. You want to merge these two AND facts into just one single quantified fact. So you want a fact of this form. For all k, ak is 0 for something. For all k, if k is in something, then ak is 0. And this something, of course, as you can imagine, you want an over approximation of that AND, but which means that you want to, since this is on the left hand side of the implication, you want an under approximation of k equals 0 and k equals 1, under approximation of the OR of these things. Okay, since because it's on the left hand side of the implication. And as you can verify that this k between 0 and 1 in the theory of naturals is an under approximation of the OR. Actually, it implies the OR. This is what it means, that it's an under approximation of the OR. And sometimes you have to do slightly more. You have to do under approximations of AND, but ANDs of implications. So it's, you have to do lots of fascinating things. But again, I'll skip these because I'm close to the end. And I'll just mention actually what you have to do if you want to build a quantified abstract domain. You need to have the ability to compute all these three things. So these are just for the base domain. You need over approximations of these three operators, but you also need under approximations of these three operators just to propagate things. Okay, so that was the part on, so this is the summary of the talk. This is what I've told you so far, okay? I started with continuous dynamical systems. I posed the verification problem. I suggested a certificate-based verification technique, which I said could be reduced to an exist-for-all formula. The same thing for hybrid systems. I suggested doing an abstraction of the hybrid system, replace the continuous dynamics by relational abstraction, and the relational abstraction computation also would reduce to an exist-for-all formula, and then this would just be verification of a discrete system. Synthesis reduces to exist-for-all. In all cases, we use an exist-for-all solver. In systems biology, you want to use simpler things that scale. So typically, you take a systems biology problem and reduce it to a simple constraint-solving problem, some kind of a linear program or just an SMT problem. In software verification, where abstract interpretation is the preferred technique, and in abstract interpretation, if you do abstract interpretation with logical domains, which I call logical interpretation, all you have to do is you need the ability to compute approximate operators, approximate ands and approximate ors under and over approximations. So this is my last slide. That is, so what has happened in the last 10 years? So you might remember, some of you might remember that my colleague Shankar gave an invited at LIX, I think in 2002 at Flock. And over there he was talking about, his talk was titled Little Engines of Proof. And he was talking about this this thing of combining little engines of proof, combining small decision procedures that work on decision procedures for different theories. And that actually led to this creation of these large set of SMT solvers, which have in some sense revolutionized the solving of for all formulas and the field of formal verification, because now people just take a formal verification problem, reduce it to an SMT problem, and just use a SMT solver. But as I, so what I've been saying in this talk is that these are the possible directions of evolution of an SMT solver, because a lot of problems are not for all problems, but they exist for all problems. We also need the ability to compute approximations of these logical operators, when especially when building abstract interpreters. Forget this part. This is another important point. When we're deciding this verification or synthesis problem, the problems are inherently undecidable. So what you do by the techniques of abstraction, or you force yourself to one path or the other. For example, when you're doing bounded model checking, you're basically saying, I'm interested in finding counterexamples. When you're doing, let's say, K-induction or proof by induction, you're basically reducing the problem and saying, I'm interested in finding the proof, in which case you've committed to either a plus answer or a no answer, okay? So you're either interested in an answer which says this formula is satisfiable, or you're interested in an answer which says the formula is unsatisfiable. This can lead to optimization. So you can build a procedure that is optimized for detecting unsatisfiability, or an optimized for detecting satisfiability of a formula, which might be faster than a procedure that uniformly tries to detect both satisfiability and unsatisfiability. So that's it. Thank you.